Lisa Davis, welcome to It's Your Health on Thinking Out Loud on WUML 91.5 FM. How do you define the good life? For many, success is measured not by health and happiness, but by financial wealth. But such a worldview overlooks the important things in life, personal contentment, family time, spirituality, and the health of the planet and those living on it. A preoccupation with money and possessions is not only unhealthy, it can also drain the true joy from life. Today's guest, John Robbins, will be talking about this and more in his fantastic book, The New Good Life. In The New Good Life, John provides a philosophical and prescriptive path from conspicuous consumption to conscious consumption. A passionate manifesto on finding meaning beyond money and status, this book delivers a sound blueprint for living well on less. John Robbins is also the author of 8 other bestsellers that have collectively sold more than 2 million copies. These include Diet for a New America, The Food Revolution, Healthy at 100, May All Be Fed, The Awakened Heart, and Reclaiming Our Health. John, welcome to It's Your Health on Thinking Out Loud on WUML 91.5 FM.
Thank you for being here with me.
Yes. Well, John, I have been a huge fan of yours for years, and I'm thrilled to have you on It's Your Health. Now, John, you were the heir to the Baskin-Robbins fortune and walked away. Can you tell us about this time in your life and what was going on for you inside?
Well, my dad and uncle were the founders and owners of Baskin-Robbins, 31 flavors. And it grew and became the world's largest ice cream company. I'm an only son. I have sisters, but I did not have brothers. And my dad was an old-fashioned kind of guy who believed that women should be taken care of by their husbands and shouldn't work. So we don't see that mindset that much anymore, but that's how he thought. And so the weight of the expectation was on me. And he groomed me to succeed him and one day follow in his footsteps and run the company. And that was his plan for my life. It was an enormously successful company. And I loved ice cream, as every kid pretty much does. Mm-hmm. And I was walking along that path with him leading me until I went to school in Berkeley, University of California, Berkeley in the 60s, and was exposed to a lot of things in the greater world that were going on. I got involved in the civil rights movement, in the protests against the war in Vietnam. I became an actively engaged citizen. And inventing a 30-second flavor ceased to be very important to me, frankly. And I began being pulled in a very different direction by my life calling. As well, in 1968, my uncle, Bert Baskin, my dad's brother-in-law and business partner, died of a heart attack. And he was in his early 50s. He was a very big man who ate a lot of ice cream. When it happened, I asked my dad, do you think there could be any connection between the amount of ice cream that my uncle Bert Baskin would eat and his fatal heart attack? And my dad was not happy with that question, and he said, no, his ticker just got tired and stopped working. And I realized that my father could not consider the possibility that there might be a connection between ice cream and heart disease, because at that time he had manufactured and sold more ice cream than any human being who had ever lived on the planet. He did not want to think. He could not tolerate thinking that the family product might have contributed to the death of his beloved brother-in-law and partner. It was just too hard for him. But I could, and I saw the connection. And it's not just Baskin-Robbins or Bert Baskin. You know, I'm sure you've heard of Ben & Jerry's. Ben Cohen, the co-founder and co-owner for many years of Ben & Jerry's, and a wonderful, wonderful man, by the way, had to undergo a quintuple bypass procedure in his late 40s.
Oh, my goodness.
And he also was a big man who obviously ate a lot of ice cream. And I'm not wanting to find fault with these men. I'm saying that for me, seeing the connection between ice cream and heart disease. And again, I've never said that eating an ice cream cone is going to hurt anybody, but the more you eat, the more likely you are to have heart disease, the more likely you are to become obese, the more likely you are to develop diabetes, which my father did quite seriously. And if you're selling the product, you want people to eat a lot of it. That's how you make the company grow. And I didn't want to be involved in that. So I walked away from that. It was a choice for integrity, for ethics, for freedom, for me personally. And I told my dad I didn't want to depend on his financial achievements. I wanted to live by my own values. And I felt at the time that I wasn't strong enough, honestly. I wasn't rooted enough in my core values to withstand the pressures of that kind of money. It was a lot of money. And I was a young man and just setting out, and I wanted to live by my own values, and I didn't see how I could if I remained in any way tethered to Baskin Robbins or the money that it had produced for the family. So I walked away from it all.
That's incredible. I mean, just to have that strengthening yourself, and then to not really, you know, after that, I know you wrote in the book that you were in school and you were washing dishes and doing other things to make money.
Yeah,
and
I did what everyone else did. It was a choice for reality. You know, I became, I was kind of living an unreal life, a very, very privileged, elitist, and I didn't want that. I wanted to live a real life. And so, yeah, I washed dishes 20 hours a week to work my way through college, and I lived very simply with my wife. And eventually our son. And, you know, we made our own way. And I eventually wrote books about health and the environment. And to my amazement, one of them became a bestseller, Diet for New America, became a runaway bestseller. And then money started to pour into our lives. And I wrote 8 subsequent books that all sold very, very well. So significant money began to pour through our lives. And I was grateful for that, frankly. I appreciated the resources, and because they came from doing something I believed in.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a huge difference.
It is. And I felt very, very fortunate. I do feel very, very privileged to be able to make a living doing something that I found meaningful. The irony is that I had kind of gone from being born into riches to chosen rags, really, because we did have very little money for many years, and then to earned riches, not the kind of money, not Baskin Robbins level money, nearly, but I was a successful author, and there was money, and then I saved it for the most part, also contributed to causes I believed in, and then we live in a three-generational household, my wife and myself. We've been together for 44 years, and our son and his wife, our daughter-in-law, Michelle, and their twins, our grand twins, who were born extremely premature and have and suffered serious oxygen deprivation to the brain at birth and afterwards, and have had a lot of special needs. So we are together raising a couple of special needs kids, and that there's financial costs attended to that for a long time. So I felt very glad that we had the money coming into our lives from my books to help. What happened was that a dear friend who was a very successful attorney, very wealthy man, who was on the boards of some of the nonprofits I founded, knew about the twins, knew about their predicament, and offered to help. He said he had an investment fund that he had his great wealth invested in, and it could be counted on to provide a steady, not astronomical, not sky high, but a steady, decent return. And so we invested all our savings with him, and in fact mortgaged our home to do that. And then on December 11th, 2008, he called and said, I've got some very, very bad news. Are you sitting down? And I said, yeah, what is it? Are you okay, Richard? Something happened? And he said, well, the money's all gone. Turns out he had invested it with a man named Bernard Madoff.
Oh, my God. Yes. When I read that, I just, oh.
Yes. I had never heard of Bernard Madoff until that moment. I was not a direct investor.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know who he was. Our money was with through my friend was with part of a fund that was several steps down the line invested with Madoff. But it was all gone, and overnight, so I went from, you know, from born into riches to chosen rags, to earned riches of a kind, to unchosen rags, because we were in a very, very deep hole suddenly. More than we lost more than 95% of our net worth overnight.
Oh my gosh!
And it was very difficult and very frightening. But we're now working our way back to sufficiency with a lot of hard work and commitment. And I wrote The New Good Life, Living Better Than Ever in an Age of Less, because I've had a lot of experience over the years living simply, making earth-friendly lifestyle choices, and doing it really from a variety of different economic perspectives. I kind of have empathy for everybody at this point, and I think that there could be a silver lining in the economic situation, as brutal as it is for many people, in that we've pursued a kind of success in this society that is defined almost exclusively in material terms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you say somebody is a success, if you say they're successful, generally speaking, what you mean by that is that they have made a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we are impoverishing ourselves, actually, by that way of thinking. Because what about the person who's creative, who lends beauty to the world? What about the person who's kind and loving and cares for others and makes a difference to the lives of other people? What about the person who you know, there's so many kinds of success at a human level that aren't defined by dollars. And I think that what really brings us to life and what gives us life isn't really money. Money is a means to an end, not an end in itself. And yet our society has propagated a way of life that's not only environmentally unsustainable, shop till the planet drops,
mm-hmm.
but it's severed our connections to our spirits. It's severed our connections to our communities. Even our families get torn apart by the economic stress of it. And I think there's a silver lining here. I think that we can pursue the new good life. We can live better than ever in an age of less if we shift from conspicuous consumption to conscious consumption. If we follow the steps, and I outline them in the New Good Life, that we can use to create a type of frugality that's not deprivation. It's not. It just shifts our focus to what really matters.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because I love clothes, but I only shop secondhand. I love secondhand clothes. They're a lot cheaper. They're not using resources. You know, I did a show recently about water usage, and I think it said it was like 1,800 gallons of water to make a pair of blue jeans.
Yeah,
so I feel good about going to the, you know,
yeah.
to the, and I'm supporting
well, I
the local
business. I support
yeah.
that, and that's one of the steps I talk about in the New Good Life, actually, is shopping at thrift shops. And there's a stigma that we have to erase.
It's true. I always brag about it.
I think the New Good Life, you know. I think you should. I think our new status, it's the new black. Is frugality.
Yes,
and
definitely.
I think that it doesn't use up resources. It doesn't depend on sweatshops. It's recycling. And
mm-hmm.
you know, think of the number of clothes that people buy and then they don't wear them and then and they go to waste. And another option, by the way, with clothes is clothing swaps, where people get together and, you know, there's clothes in their closet that they have had for a while. They loved them when they were first had them, but they don't have that anymore, that excitement, and they're not wearing them. So you get together with your friends who are, some of whom are about the same size as you are, and you trade clothes, and everybody has something new now, and it didn't cost a penny.
Yeah, it's so great. Another thing I love, man, I've been into Whole Foods for years, and you write about 12 nutritionally rich and inexpensive foods, and one of them is sweet potatoes. And actually, John, I have a sweet potato every day for breakfast, and it fills me up for hours. You know, I really stay away from processed foods. And if you
yeah.
can name some of the others, and what are your favorites out of those?
Well, I did. You know, in the New Good Life, I talk about each of the basic categories of expenditure, housing, food, transportation, and so forth, and show ways to live better than ever on less money, and food is one of them, and then I mentioned specific foods, including sweet potatoes. One of the ones that's most counterintuitive that people are really shocked by is popcorn. You know, popcorn is a whole grain.
Yes, it is.
The thing about it is, if you cover it with butter or coconut oil or a lot of salt, then you're turning it into a high-fat, high-salt food. And that's what happens in the movie theaters,
mm-hmm.
where they just drench it in often trans fatty acid oils, or you know, the worst, actually. But or saturated fats like coconut and butter. But you don't have to do that. You can get an air popper and maybe put a little bit of olive oil on it or a little bit of flaxseed oil on it, so they're healthy oils, and just a moderate amount and a little bit of salt and maybe other spices. When I make popcorn, I put on curry powder sometimes, or cumin seed powder, or chili powder, or, you know, because I like spicy foods.
Yeah, me too.
And sometimes I mix, and this is another one of those foods that I mentioned, is nutritional yeast. Very, very high in nutrition, inexpensive. People don't know about it, but they can learn about it and learn how to use it, and it's very, very tasty. Very high in B vitamins and protein. So you can make popcorn into a very healthy food, and it's so inexpensive. It's so inexpensive that it's sometimes used as packing material. What a waste.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, that is a waste. You know, another great thing about the book, too, is you talk about, you know, you say having a clean house is nice, and many of the products used to clean are not. I like that.
Yeah, well, they
and there's some things you should never buy. Oh, pardon me?
Because they endanger our health. They include toxic ingredients.
Yes, they do. And there's vinegar and baking soda and
there's
all
basic
different
things like vinegar and baking soda that
mm-hmm.
you can learn how to use, and I describe how to do that in The New Good Life.
Yeah.
So that people can save a lot of money, $200-$400 a year on
mm-hmm.
average, and do a better job and greatly reduce the exposure to pollutants and contaminants in the household.
Yeah, that's important. Definitely.
So you have healthier kids. And,
it's true.
And I think that's a really positive step. That's an example of the new good life, is learning to use non-toxic ingredients, non-toxic cleaning products, non-toxic personal care, bath and beauty products, that are simple, that are cheap, that work very well, and that don't pollute your body or your
yeah.
health.
No, it's true. I mean, I only eat good food. I'm not going to be using crummy, you know, products like that.
Exactly.
No.
There are some people who eat good food, but they put creams on their bodies that are full of
That's a really important point. Yeah, I'm very careful about that, too. But, I used to live in Santa Cruz, and I believe that's where you are. And, you know, you talk about traffic in the book. Now, when I lived in Santa Cruz, this was like 20 years ago because I went to UC Santa Cruz. I didn't have a car, and I walked and rode my bike and took public transportation, and it's great. Well, now it's a little tougher. I live on the East Coast. I live in the suburbs. And it's cold here from like October till May.
Yes, I understand. I lived in Canada.
Maybe I can, you know, snowshoe places. Yeah, so it's definitely changed. But I still try to walk when I can and ride my bike. But it's a different kind of lifestyle. But I think if you do live in a climate that is more temperate, you definitely can take advantage of those things. Or just, you know, wear lots of layers and try to do it.
And
here
you
too.
Can take advantage of them in any climate, certain
yes.
months of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, in choosing where you're going to live, and that's not a choice most of us make every day, of course, but we do make it occasionally. And it's a very important choice with serious financial implications. Housing is the largest single category of expenditure for most households,
mm-hmm.
be that rent or mortgage, and it's substantial. And one of the things that I talk about as a possible step for people is if you can locate yourself closer to your work, so you don't have a long commute and don't have to drive so much, that saves more money than you realize. Polls show that 98% of Americans consistently underestimate the true cost of driving. I mean, they know what they pay at the gas pump and perhaps their monthly payment on the car, but the depreciation, the repairs and maintenance, the insurance, all the ways that it adds up, not to mention how much time it takes out of your life.
Yes, it really
And
is.
I don't think, I mean, one of my chapters is titled Life is Too Short for Traffic.
You know, for sure.
Quality of life and sitting in rush hour traffic. Why do they call it rush hour, by the way? You're doing anything but rushing. You know?
I've always wondered that, too.
Yeah. I think it's
sit still traffic. Not going anywhere, wasting your life traffic.
Yeah, the distress, they call them expressways. I think they should call them distress ways.
Oh, really? Yeah, that's
but, you
what
know,
I like
but
that.
We need to make our lives less dependent on the automobile if we can. And I think that given the likelihood, I would say the near certainty that gas prices are going to go up, that the price of oil is going to go up in the years to come.
Yes.
The more you can make your life, the less dependent on automobile you can make your life, the better.
Yes.
If you can get by as a household with one car instead of two, if you can live in a place where there's good public transportation, or in a place where you can walk or bicycle or to some of or all of the things you basically need, the less dependent on cars and trucks that you can make yourself, the better. Now, I realize not everyone can do that,
mm-hmm.
but it shows a direction that we can move towards, and particularly when there's major lifestyle decisions like where are we going to live. A lot of people in the old good life have subscribed to the belief that more is better. And so the bigger the house, the more square footage, the better.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to acquire that large home, they have taken on high mortgages, and then in order to bring the cost of the mortgage down into a monthly payment that's doable, they get a 40-year mortgage instead of a 15, and then they're in debt forever. And now a lot of people are getting bitten in the butt by that. It's very painful, very tragic in many cases. If another thing that people have done in order to get that larger square footage with the bigger is better mentality is they've moved out into farther out into the suburbs with bigger, longer commutes.
Mm-hmm.
So they get the big home, but they got to drive an hour every day each way. That's got real costs attendant to it that aren't immediately apparent. I think the new good life is more small is beautiful and less bigger is better.
Yeah, I agree. You know, when I grew up, my father was an ophthalmologist, and he still is, and all of his colleagues lived in these mansions with tennis courts and swimming pools and these outrageous bathrooms. I would just stand in there and be like, wow, I could swim in that bathtub. And I always would ask my dad what, and we lived in a simple home, you know, every fourth tract home's the same. It was like a basic middle-class neighborhood. And I said, I don't understand, why do we live here? And he said, because you don't need that kind of a house. And I'm so glad he instilled those values in me, because I've always felt that way.
Yeah, the trophy house, it's ego. It's impressing others. It's image. And it's expensive. And what a waste of your, you know, time and energy to have to make the money to feed that ego machine. If we can live more simply, closer to the earth, closer to ourselves, closer to our families, closer to nature, closer to what gives us life and what brings us life, I think that's a real step, and I think that's the new good life.
Yeah, it sure is, and I really enjoyed the book. And, John, it has been so wonderful having you on It's Your Health. Now, how can people learn more about you and your wonderful
Well,
work?
There is a website, johnrobbins.info is the name of the website, John Robbins. Robbins is R-O-B-B-I-N-S, two B's. johnrobbins.info, I-N-F-O, is my website. The New Good Life just went on sale yesterday on Amazon and in bookstores, and it's selling really well. Actually, it's off to a wonderful start. I think I wrote it to be of service and of use to people with a lot of practical steps, down to earth, real steps you can take to live in a way that doesn't cost you an arm and a leg, and in fact has a higher quality of life.
Yes, I completely agree. And if people want to reach me, they can go to itsyourhealthradio.org. I hope everyone has a great day. Keep being healthy. Get the New Good Life by John Robbins. Take care. Bye-bye.